Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amy Bloom, whose latest novel is Lucky Us. This is her seventh book. Other books include Away, Love Invents Us, Normal, Come to Be. I've interviewed Amy twice for both Love Invents Us and Away. This book, Lucky Us, deals with a period of time just prior to World War II and shortly after World War II. And I understand it began because you were interested in an actress named Eva LeGallien. She was very well known in her time as a stage actress, but is pretty much forgotten today. You read one of her biographies?
Yes, there was a brilliant biography. I think Gail Shee is the writer, and she was a great actress. She was also a great director. She was also a great driving force in American theater, really had a big hand in creating American repertory theater, and was an out and open lesbian, and was beautiful, and was smart, and was charming, and had her pretty face and her neck and one of her hands damaged in a fire, and learned how to do makeup and lighting so that she could conceal all that and go on acting. So she was, to me, a very compelling character, and I gave her name to the younger hero of the novel, Eva, and I gave some of her temperament to the older sister, Iris.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Okay, you finished Away. You were just writing short stories, I would assume, at that point. What brought you to decide to focus in on this particular period of time and on, not Eva LeGallien, of course, but on a story that kind of surrounds her life?
If you read history at all, it's hard not to be compelled by the period of World War II. It's just, it's alive, it's moving, it's turbulent. Everyone's lives are changed by it, and opportunities emerge. So that was very compelling. Plus, in terms of public life and public response, the parallels between the Roosevelts and the Obamas are a little hard to miss, right down to the exact wording of the vitriol and the hatred. So that was also compelling to me. And I think the other thing was that Hollywood, which was really not Eva LeGallien's world, was a great entree into this. I love backstage. I love to be backstage in a theater or a movie set or a TV set or even the opera or a dance performance. I just, to be in the wings, to see how things are made and done and how the magic happens on stage is always great fun for me. So that was the other thing that brought me in. I could see these two sisters, the ambitious starlet-to-be and her sidekick.
When you're writing, when you're working, do you kind of have an idea before you actually sit down, or in that first draft, does it just kind of happen?
I'm sure that must be true for other people. It is not the case for me that in the first draft it just happens. I probably spend a couple of years thinking about it before I start writing.
And that first draft, by that point, I guess you know the basic contours of the story and most of the characters?
I do know most of the characters, probably the central six, and then other people begin to emerge. Somebody goes to the grocery store, they meet somebody, something is different, that character is compelling, that person comes into the story. When I was originally creating the novel, I didn't know that Beatriz and Encarnacion were going to be important figures in the novel, but there they were with La Belladonna Beauty Salon of East Brooklyn.
At that point, you have kind of the basic structure. You know where you're going. Have you started on research at that point? I mean, how much research have you done?
Oh, I will have done the research long before I start writing. I might do a little research while I'm writing as a way of avoiding writing, but mostly the research is done before I start.
Some people also will do research if they hit a snag to see if they could get past the snag. Did that happen to you?
Sure. Research to get over a bump is always a good idea, as is taking a walk, as is going to the movies, as is going out for a little sushi and sake by yourself. All those. Anything that gets you over the bump is worth doing as long as, you know, nobody innocent is harmed in the process.
Amy Bloom, let's talk a little about these characters. You had Eva and Iris, the two sisters. They're half-sisters because at one point Eva's mom drops Eva off with her father, who is already married and has a child. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what the origin of that particular dynamic?
I think I was interested in creating sisters who didn't know each other as children. My sister is 6 years older than I am, and we really had very little relationship until I was older, until I was about 12. And I think that that really stayed with me. I don't think it hurt our relationship, but it did create a different kind of relationship in that we came together more as teenagers and less as, you know, constant playmates or rivals during our childhood.
And then you have them go off to Hollywood, which, as you said, is kind of like a fun place for you. And they meet a makeup artist named Francisco. Was he based on a real person?
His overall self is not based on anybody. It is true that when I have worked sometimes in television, there have been some great makeup artists, often older gay men, who were clearly in some important ways the fathers to everybody who was working backstage. And this character began to develop, and I just thought, what a great guy, and who does not want him in their life and for this journey?
I was curious about one thing, which is that when they leave Hollywood at a certain point, he goes with them. Did you give that much thought?
I did actually give that some thought, and it's not a big explanation, but it's a couple of sentences which says that he seems to have had sort of a love affair that went south, and he says he's tired of standing on his feet all day. He's been doing this for 35 years. That's long enough.
And so he travels with them, and suddenly we're on a road trip. They wind up in New York in Great Neck, in the era, I guess it's just the post-Scott Fitzgerald era, though there is a reference in the book.
Well, it is very much the post-F. Scott Fitzgerald period, and the thing that really marks it as post-F. Scott Fitzgerald is that Jews are allowed to live there, which they had not been previously. And it's a very different world than it was even 20 years ago, even 15 years ago. There are a lot of foreclosures. The Depression hits Great Neck very hard. And suddenly people who were not socially acceptable, everybody is more than happy to have them. Not in the mansions, which they couldn't afford, but in the small two-bedroom Levittown-style houses near the train station.
Why did you pick Great Neck?
It's because where I was brought up. I didn't live there after high school, but that is where I was brought up. And the history of Great Neck, which I didn't know when I was growing up there, was really very interesting socially and culturally, and the changes in the community. You know, I grew up thinking, oh, here I am in this predominantly Jewish suburb. But, of course, because children know nothing of history, I didn't understand that it had only been a Jewish suburb for 20 years.
You know, that entire area is very Jewish. You know, down toward Lake Success, mm-hmm. and even Little Neck area, and over by Lakeville Road. And, of course, you've got, mm-hmm. you know, the Jewish hospital.
Right. And the history of the Long Island Jewish Hospital was also very interesting, because until that hospital existed, there were no hospitals on Long Island where Jewish doctors had admitting privileges.
Iris is forced to leave Hollywood because she's discovered that she's in a lesbian affair, similar to Eva Le Gallien. There's a long sequence at a lesbian party. Is that based on any history?
Well, it certainly is based on history in the sense that, obviously, gay actors and actresses, and the more famous, the more true it was, were not allowed to be open about their sexuality. And people were very careful and very closeted, and so there was a real push for the private party, and these were often very lavish, very beautiful, highly orchestrated, and often, you know, pretty sexy places to be. So in that sense, it's absolutely based in history, and also it is, I have to say, that particular orgy is really the pleasure of a good imagination.
Well, she comes into contact with a much more famous actress named Rose, who eventually must offer her up. There were instances, I would assume, of that happening.
Oh, it happened all the time. You could either get the gossip item buried and no harm done, and everybody then sort of behave themselves more carefully. But sometimes it was more profitable for one person to sacrifice the other in hopes of sort of moving up the ladder. And because the studios were so powerful, these ladders were pretty clearly marked, and people like Hedda Hopper and other gossip columnists wielded a lot of power and worked very closely with the studios, and that was not an unusual thing to happen. I also just want to point out that Rose Sawyer, who is the wicked starlet, actually first appears in Away as Lillian's cousin Razel. At the end of Away, Raisel is on the verge of success in Hollywood, and I decided to give her that success. So Raisel appears as a wicked, cold-hearted cousin in a way, and a wicked, cold-hearted starlet in Lucky Us, and I have no doubt that she will make a cameo appearance as a wicked, cold-hearted something else in the next novel.
Amy Bloom, they go to New York, they go to Great Neck. Iris falls in love with a woman named Renee. Don't go into that too much because it's part of the story, but let's talk a little bit about Gus, Renee's husband, because that opened up an entire new area, which is what happens to Germans during World War II. We know about what happened to Japanese Americans, but we don't know too much about Germans. Where did you uncover that, and what made you decide to make that a portion of the novel?
I really stumbled across it in some internet research. I wasn't even at something as legitimate as a library. I had just been thinking about that, and I had been thinking about internment. And I remember hearing that there had been internment camps in South Dakota and North Dakota. And if you type in internment camp North Dakota, you will immediately be directed to websites of first-person accounts of life in one of these camps on the part of Germans. And with the Italians, we basically put people in camps, or we held them in Ellis Island for 2 to 3 months, and then we stopped. And it was basically a question of the American government turning to its citizens and going, no hard feelings, we were just being careful. And it was sort of a forgive-and-forget attitude. With the Germans, there was no such thing. And also, what was interesting to me is that there were never any reparations made either. And in many ways, the government was much more frightened of the Germans than it was of the Japanese. And so the decision was made to keep them much longer. Truman had announced that he was not going to close the camps where the Germans were held until 1947. So the government offered people who were in the camps the opportunity to, as they said then, self-deport. And so some people who had lived in America their whole lives, often people who spoke no German at all or very little German, went to Germany by boat at the expense of the American government, were swapped for American POWs, and basically handed about $25 in the middle of the winter, and good luck.
Did any of them survive by saying that they were Jewish?
Amazingly, because there was no shortage of irony in the world, there were Jews that we imprisoned when they escaped Germany in the late 30s or even into the early 40s who were picked up by the federal government because, after all, they were German. And some of those people spent at least a year in an internment camp in the United States.
And the Germans who went over there, was it common, as it is with Gus, afterward to take on new identities?
I don't know about that. It's hard for me to imagine that people did not see an opportunity, as people almost always do in the midst of terrible crisis and confusion, to refine and reinvent their identity.
What I've noticed in the entire book, Lucky Us, is a constant reinvention, not just Gus, but all of the characters on a regular basis reinvent, and they hide who they were, hidden Jews, hidden African Americans, hidden lesbians even. It's almost a theme.
It is a theme. I don't even think it's almost a theme. It wasn't my intention, but it is clear to me that one of the things that really engages me in this book is that process of reinvention. And also, for me, even though there is hiding, there's this quality of how does one shed one's skin without losing oneself? Because the original self is never gone. It may not be visible, but it is still informing your life. And both the original self and the shedding of skins were both equally interesting to me.
Some of the characters, in particular Gus, Iris, and Eva, we hear it from their own voice. Mm-hmm. Which of these voices was the easiest to create and which the hardest?
It's an interesting question. I think that Gus was the first voice. I heard his voice very clearly. I heard it in the letters that he wrote home. I didn't even know who he was writing to, but I could hear the letters. And then Iris also was hard in some ways, but not in others, because there was a particular sort of actressy voice. I often thought of her accent as being sort of Madonna-like, you know, sort of mysteriously transatlantic, not quite American, not quite English. And Eva, because her narrative is the spine of the book, came last.
As I was reading the book, I noticed several interesting things I didn't pick up on. I'd never heard of these things called Little Blue Books.
Little Blue Books are a wonderful thing. They were a nickel a piece, then they were a dime a piece, and they were formatted to fit in the back of a man's pocket so that working men could take one out during their coffee break or their lunch break or over dinner and a beer and educate themselves. They were designed for intelligent but not particularly educated people who wished to know more about the world. And so they covered everything from the short stories of Balzac to the principles of psychoanalysis, to What Every Married Woman Should Know, which was actually written by Margaret Sanger, to How to Make Candy.
Have you seen these?
I have. They are beautiful little things. They are utterly homely. They are not pretty. They are not fancy. They are what librarians call ephemera, you know, paper things that will be destroyed by age eventually, and they are just little marvels from a period when it was considered important to understand things.
You also have a character named Clara who suffers from vitiligo. As I was reading about her and how she had to put on makeup in order to have the same color on her face, I kept thinking of Michael Jackson. People accused him of trying to be white, but he may not have had a choice.
The loss of pigment certainly alters your appearance. It is not only African Americans who suffer from it, but it is more common and obviously very noticeable. And I was just interested again in the possibility that that sort of disaster offered a person. And Clara absolutely knows who she is. She understands herself. She is in many ways a very proud black woman, but she also sees the opportunity and the mischief in periodically performing as a white one.
While she is fully capable of understanding her being black, I noticed that you do ask a question, again, a subtextual question, about what it means to be a Jew, because we have characters who are hiding their Jewishness, pretending to be Jews, and also upfront Jews.
You know, I think as Clara says about race, she says, you know, it's not just a matter of appearance, but it is also a matter of appearance. And I think in terms of Jews in a largely non-Jewish society, it is not just a matter of religion, but it is also a matter of religion. And it's not just a matter of the tribe, but it's also a matter of the tribe. And I don't have any answers for these things, but I think the way in which people move through them and sort them out and tell the truth and don't tell the truth is always very interesting.
Did you know all of the secrets when you started writing?
I think I did. I think I did know everybody's secret. It took me a while in writing them to find the point at which the secret might be uncovered. But I think because I tend to write from sort of the inside of the character, not looking at them but being them, the secrets were not a surprise to me.
Well, I mentioned before that there were humps that you have to work to get over. Can you describe any of the dead ends that you hit and how you overcame them?
You know, if you're a professional writer, you hit the humps all the time. You just try not to, like, get knocked off your bicycle. Oh, for a while I was more interested in Eva Le Gallienne, and I wanted to pursue the characters being more in the theater and write more about Iris's venture into the New York theater. But then that stopped for me. For a while, Iris had a more successful love affair towards the end of her life, and there was a lot of writing about that, but then I really wanted to keep the novel in just the span of 10 years. I didn't want to see them all the way through. I'm trying to think if there were any other. Yeah, I had no idea what Eva was going to do for a living when she grew up until that became clear to me through an unfortunate accident in the novel. So I think, honestly, a day without speed bumps as a writer is a pretty terrific day.
Well, Eva becomes a phony psychic.
And a good phony psychic, too.
Is it possible to survive in a career as a bad phony psychic?
I don't even know if it's possible to survive in a career as a bad genuine psychic, whatever that would mean. But Eva is a fake. She knows she's a fake, and she applies her intelligence to being as good a fake as she knows how to be.
You have a character who appears to be a real psychic, too.
Yes. That is one of the few characters in the book who is based on a real person. My dad was a journalist, and he was doing a piece, I think, for Esquire magazine on the disappearance of Judge Crater, which was a famous story in the 40s, and this was then in the 60s, that he was writing about it. And the FBI, with the help of Interpol, had brought a psychic to America. And he was Dutch and living in France, and my father somewhat unexpectedly asked me if I wanted to go on the search in the Adirondacks for Judge Crater. And I was about 10 years old. I said, sure. And the story that I describe between Eva and Monsieur Croisette, the psychic, in which he tells her to think of something and then draws exactly that on the placemat, did actually happen to me when I was a little girl.
Someone did that with you?
He did. And it was remarkable because there was nothing about what I was thinking that was in any way reflected in our environment. I don't have much of an explanation because I'm a real rationalist. On the other hand, you know, as they say, when you are confronted with evidence, sometimes the simplest explanation is the only one. And the simple explanation for this is that he could see what I was thinking.
Amy Bloom, you were trained as a psychotherapist. How does that training work in terms of creating characters in the context of a novel? Does it?
The training doesn't really help in creating characters because the work of psychotherapy is working with an actual person and their actual story and paying attention to what has already happened. So I am not really free to imagine other histories for them. I think the real help in the training was keep your mouth shut and your eyes open. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't finish people's sentences. Don't assume that because you know what they look like, you know who they are. And that training was enormously helpful.
Does that work in the context of the actual writing or just the observation of being a writer?
I think in the observation. I mean, I think that these are useful habits in life, but I think in beginning to develop character, in looking at the world around you, in paying attention, in not thinking that the only viewpoint is your own, all of those things are really helpful in the process of writing and telling a story.
One other area I would like to go into here is the continuing story of Gus. He goes over to Germany. He goes over to the town of Forzheim and gets caught in the bombing raids of Dresden. Mm-hmm. Did you know that was going to happen, or as you were writing it, did you suddenly go, aha?
I didn't know it was going to happen, but as I was doing my research, I realized that the timing was right and that was very likely to happen. And again, it was not such a tiny event that it only happened to a few people. And it was clear to me, I began to look at some of the smaller cities that were bombed. And I also began to look at the speeches of Bomber Harris, who was in the Royal Air Force, who made it very clear in his speeches that the creation of refugees and the death of civilians was not a byproduct of their bombing raids. It was the intention.
You've decided to give chapter titles the names of songs from the era. What are you doing?
In some sense, I always feel like that's for the reader to say. I think the music of that period is a tremendously important part of the culture, and it was something that everybody participated in. And I don't mean that every single person in America listened to the same music. You know, there were people who listened to Bing Crosby, and there were people who listened to Billie Holiday, and they were not necessarily the same people. But there was a lot of overlap for adult Americans. Music was a huge part of everybody's social life. You know, if you began humming a song at a gas station, there was an excellent chance that the adults near you, even if they were not the same gender, even if they were not the same color, would actually know the song. And so I was very interested in the way the music ran through the culture. For me, I mean, the song titles are very particular. If you know the song, then that's a little plus because you can hear the tune in the background as you are reading. And if you don't, the fact is that the lines themselves, Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year, are so evocative, you don't need to know the song. And I think in general, you know, I grew up reading a lot of 19th century fiction, and so the chapter title always feels to me like an additional, it's like a little gift that the writer gives to the reader.
And what about the title of the book, Lucky Us?
Harold Bloom and I adopted each other as cousins kind of late in his life. And when I told him about the title, Lucky Us, he said, "Oh, my dear, so hopeful, so ominous." And that is how I feel about Lucky Us.
And where did it come from?
It's just an expression I use in my family.
Amy Bloom, changing the subject a little, 2007, you worked on a television show called State of Mind. How did you get into it, and what happened with it?
I got into it because a couple of producers really liked my short stories and said, "Have you ever thought about writing a television show?" And I said, "Certainly not." And then we began to talk more, and then I thought, oh, I could do a fun show, sort of a dramedy about a bunch of psychotherapists and their private lives and their professional life together, sort of loosely based on my own practice that I was in years before. And we sold it to NBC, which was great, and then NBC at that time got a new president who said, as I recall quite distinctly, "I'm not interested in conversation and I'm not interested in women." And I thought, oh, there goes my show. And that languished for a couple of years, and then Lifetime was in a moment of, we're not just going to be the network for women, and we're going to do edgier, more interesting programming. We'd love to do this, and off we were running, and Lily Taylor was our lead. We had some terrific actors. We had some differences of opinion with Lifetime, entirely, as they say, creative differences. We stood our ground, and we got 8 episodes out of it, and I'm proud of the 8 episodes. I hope I get to do more TV work. But it won't be that show.
You wrote all the episodes?
No, we had a writer's room. We had terrific people working with us. Of the 8 episodes, I wrote 3.
Who was the showrunner? Was it you? Or?
Well, we were sort of what we called a mom and mom business, which was Greer Shepherd of Shepherd Robin, and I were the showrunners.
Were you on set a lot?
I was on set every day.
Really?
It was the most fun. It was for me, it was the Amy Bloom summer camp for showrunners. I learned how to do it. I loved learning how to do it. I found it, as I've said, since I'm a backstage kind of gal, endlessly interesting and lots of fun.
Do you think at some point you'll want to write specifically about creating a TV show? Because that would be really interesting.
Oh, that might be fun. You know, in general, I think that ground has been pretty well covered, and I'm not sure that anybody would want to do it. I'm not a sitcom writer. I mean, I admire great sitcoms, but I actually don't know how to write them. And I don't know if anybody really wants to do an hour-long show about that that doesn't have the high stakes and moral high ground of some of the other shows about creating television. And there have also been some great shows about it. I don't really feel the need to do it.
How about a novel?
Oh, a novel in which somebody writes for television or creates a show? Yeah, you never know. Life is long.
Amy Bloom, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview a relationship between how people treat Obama and how they treated Roosevelt, how the opposition. Can you go into that a little bit more?
To read the articles, including editorials in sort of standard conservative newspapers, and to look at the political cartoons, the only word you can use is hateful. I mean, we think now, ah, the end of civility, the end of decent discourse, this is so shameful, and it certainly is, but it has been going on before, and the attacks on Roosevelt and the sneering condemnation of, you know, things like his interest in the poor, in which he was described as a traitor to his class. There were Roosevelt burnings in effigies at country clubs up and down the East Coast. Extraordinary.
On the other hand, poor people loved him. There was no Tea Party either.
No, there was no Tea Party, and the poor did love him. And they loved him because there was no reason for him to care. And nevertheless, he did. I will also say that one of the primary reasons he did is because he was married to Eleanor. She guided him, and it was not always the best thing for their marriage, but it was an excellent thing in their partnership. And, you know, she would push to the left and he would steer down the middle and tilt a little towards the more progressive, the more caring, the more empathetic, the notion that people were entitled to live decently and that it was in the interest of our country to make that happen.
And as you were writing this book, Lucky Us, that was always in the back of your mind.
It was always in the back of my mind. I'm interested in politics and I'm interested in history, and that all circled around quite a bit for me, and most of my characters are not The Torellis are a wealthy family, recently wealthy, in nouveau riche. But by and large, the characters I write about are not wealthy people.
Earlier, you also talked a little bit about these songs that everyone knew. And while you were talking, I was thinking another difference between then and now is that we don't have that many cultural touchstones anymore. It seems to have faded.
That's absolutely true. I mean, once you no longer had three television networks that everybody who had it was lucky enough to have a TV watched, all of that has just, you know, devolved more into sort of niche programming. And there are a lot of wonderful things about niche programming. I am, you know, a niche program watcher. But it's also true that that big river of musical culture that everybody tapped into, not that you didn't go off on your own smaller tributaries, but everybody tapped into the big middle, doesn't really exist anymore.
What do you think we've lost?
Well, for me, part of what you've lost is a lot of great music, but I think you've also lost that sense of, even if it was attenuated, even if it was only in passing, a sense that you shared cultural markers with most of the people you met who were at least if they were in your age group.
And this is kind of sound weird. It seems like the only thing in common sometimes is, oh, I'm an A's fan, I'm a Giants fan, I'm a Yankee fan.
Yes, and people certainly adopt that and hang on to that, and I think it serves a lot of cultural purposes. Since I am not such a sports fan, I don't have that available to me. For men, it's often sports. For women, it's often, oh, I have children.
Could that be one of the reasons why there's, for women in particular, there's this rise of reading groups?
I'm sure there is a need among lots of people, men and women, for a sense of smaller community, of connectedness, of this is what we have in common. Part of what happens is when entertainment becomes so successful in the passive form, you have fewer people getting together to entertain themselves and each other in person in small groups. It is, you know, as people have written in the last 30 years, it is the difference between watching something on your phone and being in a bowling league.
As someone who promotes theater, live theater on the radio, you know, I can also see the difference between going out, being in an audience where you are not only part of the audience, but the people on stage are part of the entertainment. And that's different than, say, a movie, because it brings you back to community.
It does. I'm a huge live theater fan. The first show I ever saw, I was 5 years old, and it was My Fair Lady with Julie Andrews. And my mother said, I never sat down. I was so taken with it and so compelled by it. And, I will be promoting theater and going to theater until they close the last one, I'm sure.
Amy Bloom, 8-year break between novels. Were you starting other work at the time?
I did a bunch of television projects. I wrote a children's book. I did have a collection of short stories come out. I wasn't doing nothing. It always makes it sound like, oh, my gosh, you just sat around for 7 years. It was only 7 years, by the way. But nevertheless, point taken. But I'm a slow writer.
A question I ask a lot of authors, and I get different answers. When some people write books, the books come, they're children, they go into the world, move on. But there's also the fact that when you're writing, for some writers, not all of them, the books, the writing of the books changes them in some way, makes them see something new. Did that happen with you with this book or any of your books?
I'm sure each time something changes a little bit. It's usually I see it after the book is published, not while I'm writing it. You know, I remember when my first short story collection came out about a year or two afterwards, I thought, oh, I see now that I was going to get divorced, and that certainly wasn't clear to me when I was writing those short stories, nor would I have wished to have known that, I think. In Lucky Us, I am always a pretty dark optimist in the sense that my motto is hope for the best, prepare for the worst, and that is unlikely to change at this point in my life. I don't think I ever wrote anything in which that is so clearly expressed as this novel, that almost every character at one point or another is clearly going down a path of hope for the best, prepare for the worst, and often live through the worst as well. I had not thought that I would be writing about optimism, but that is also clearly part of what I'm writing about.
Amy Bloom, have you begun thinking about your next novel?
I have. It will fit in between Away and Lucky Us chronologically. It's set in the 30s. Some of the backdrop is the Roosevelt administration and, in fact, the love affair between Eleanor Roosevelt and Lenora Hickok, the journalist that she was in love with, who also became her dear friend for many years. And it's partially I was interested because we do a lot of who is the woman behind the great man, but in this case it is really who is the woman behind the great woman. And it's a very interesting, complicated, turbulent relationship. There are other stories in that as well.
It seems to me that when you began talking about the Obama-Roosevelt connection, I could hear a passion in your voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just they were extraordinary people. They lived in an extraordinary time. And she, in particular, was a very complicated and interesting woman and very self-aware and aware of her faults as well as her strengths and also deeply charming.
You wish you had met her.
I do wish I had met her, and it is my impression that no one who met her and spent time with her, when she was clearly, you look at the photographs, not a head-turner, pretty plain, and everybody who knew her thought she was beautiful.
You've been listening to an interview with Amy Bloom, whose latest novel is Lucky Us. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.